Welcome to episode 69 of the DFA Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, my co-host and partner in crime, RJ Anderson. RJ, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I can't complain. We are beyond the more exciting part of the deadline. We're on to the minor moves that you see happen all over the place in August. We've got a couple of really kind of interesting things to talk about, I feel like, this week, but we're into August baseball, and August baseball is a lot of fun. It's way more fun than September baseball.
Oh, absolutely, because you actually know most of the players partaking in the games, and you don't have to worry about, you know, reading complaints about how it's not fair, but some teams have, you know, 37, 38 players, while others are closer to 30. So I do agree, August is funner than September. Plus, you know, there's still enough time to envision some of these teams rallying and making up the, you know, the deficit in their division or in the wild card race. Whereas September, the, you know, realities of life and our mortality start to come into clearer focus. So yeah, August beats September, no doubt.
Yeah, and you know, we're recording this on Wednesday morning, and at this point, every single division in the National League is within 2.5 games. You know, the Braves are only a game and a half behind the Phillies. The Brewers are 2.5 behind the Cubs. The Diamondbacks are just a half game behind the Dodgers, and the Rockies are just 2.5 games behind the Dodgers. So it's like we got some like legit pennant races going on right now, which hopefully will drive some, you know, fun August post deadline moves that we can talk about. But we've got a few that we can already talk about that are kind of interesting. We'll start things off with our big move of the episode. The big move is actually a couple of moves, and they're by a team that have been a source of discussion, I think, throughout our podcast this year, the Oakland Athletics. They made two moves that are very interesting, I think, independently, and in a pair, they're kind of even more interesting. The first thing is that they went out and they got Mike Fiers, the starting pitcher from the Detroit Tigers, for either two players to be named later or cash. Then, in addition to that, they picked up the scraps of the very strange DFA of Sean Kelly by the Nationals for throwing his glove on the mound during a blowout. So they were able to pick up Sean Kelly from the Nationals for a little bit of international bonus pool money. So between these two moves, the A's have at least shored up the depth in their rotation in their bullpen en route to trying to take this second wild card spot and or maybe the AL West. So what do you think about these two moves?
I think they're fine. It is kind of interesting to me that their two acquisitions are not guys who are necessarily going to move the needle. I think we all anticipated Billy Bean would try to do something wild because, you know, that's what Billy Bean is wont to do in these situations. And at the same time, it's also interesting that both of these guys have had issues with the home run ball this season. You know, they have shiny ERAs. You know, their other peripherals are fine to strong. But you look at their home run rates, and I mean, Fiers has given up, what, like 1.6 home runs per nine, which is not what you necessarily expect from a guy who's seemingly having a good year. You would think that that would be a bad thing for him. But so far, it seems like the sequencing gods are smiling down on him, and he's not giving up the multiple run home runs that can ruin an ERA in a hurry. So it's kind of interesting, and it makes me wonder if the A's are trying to take advantage of their ballpark, you know, that spacious, you know, tons of foul ground, all that good stuff, and maybe trying to leverage that. But I don't know. Neither of these guys really move a needle for me. Fiers obviously slots in nicely to that rotation that kind of features a couple of ghosts and corpse already. He's an upgrade over presumably, you know, Brett Anderson and, you know, maybe Edwin Jackson if you're mean and don't believe in Edwin Jackson's resurgence. But I don't know. He's not a guy you necessarily want starting for you in the postseason. And then with Kelly, I mean, this is just, I don't know. I don't have any negative thoughts here. I think it's fine to go out there and get him. And it's kind of interesting what the Nationals did. We'll talk about that later in the show. But yeah, these are fine moves. Do you have any issue with them? Any big takes, so to speak?
Not really. I do think Fiers is a really kind of underrated move for the A's. You're right about the home run issues, but that's a permanent issue for Mike Fiers. He is a real serious home run guy. He allows a ton of them. Once the ball started getting juiced last year, it got even worse. He's a really interesting kind of performance-wise pitcher, but his strikeouts are down this year. His walks are down, which is kind of, I think, what's helping him get, like you said, the sequencing gods are helping him out. He's stranding guys at a ridiculous rate, but his ground balls are down. He's actually not giving up a ton of home runs per fly ball, which is, in his case, probably luck at this point because it's way under his career home run per fly rate. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting outing for him moving to a home run suppressing park, which should bode well for him. But no matter what, he's probably an upgrade, like you said, over, I would say, at least Brett Anderson, and he'll at least give a different look than Brett Anderson. He's a very different pitcher than the lefty Anderson. So maybe they could try using some guys in a, shorter outings and pairing guys up kind of look. But yeah, the A's really do have to mix and match their starters, so it's very interesting to see them like try a bunch of different things. And then Kelly for the bullpen, it's a no-brainer. He's still talented enough to be a really nice fit in the middle of any sort of bullpen for a team that's contending. And the A's have added a, he's not the first guy who's had some personal issues, not nearly to the level of Juris Familia, but they've kind of taken advantage of getting some guys who have fallen out of favor with their teams with this deadline.
Yeah, and on Fires and the home run rate, I just want to bring up that he ranks 14th among pitchers with more than 100 innings this season. It's 1.51. I said 1.6 up, and so I actually was a little meaner than I needed to be there. But there are 14 pitchers over 1.5 this season. His 1.28 ERA plus is the highest. Mm-hmm. And of those 14, only four have an ERA plus over 100. So you could probably expect him to regress a little bit just from, that point of view. Whereas, maybe if he had a lower home run rate, you'd be a little bit more willing to buy into some of these changes he's made or whatever. But yeah, it's an interesting pair of deals, and I think it should help the A's. And of course, they have a very interesting opportunity to perhaps, steal the American League West, because right now the Astros have a lot of injuries. Their starting middle infield's out, Brian McCann's out, George Springer's out, Lance McCullers Jr.'s out. I don't think it's likely because, look at the names we're talking about with this A's rotation, and look at some of the – I mean, let's put it this way. Do you know who started the last 3 days for the A's in center field?
I assume it's Ramon Laureano. They called him up to replace Dustin Fowler, right?
Okay, you knew who it was. See, I think if he pulled – I don't know. If he just pulled everyone on baseball Twitter, what percentage of people do you think would know – who had started for them over the last 2 days?
Oh, no question. He's kind of a cipher at this point. But actually, I think yesterday Mark Canha started in center field, which is, extremely on brand for this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Canha was like the topic of discussion in our very first episode, if I recall right. It was Mark Canha in episode one, and then in episode two, Andrew Triggs. So apparently the A in the podcast stands for
designated for athletics.
There you go. And also, I was stalling there so I could run the numbers. And the median ERA plus for the 14 pitchers with home run rates over 1.5 is 90. So if Mike Fiers just pitches like an average or thereabout average member of this group, he'll have a 90 ERA plus. I would have to say that that's almost a win for the A's, right? If he's like, that's a little bit below average for a starting pitcher, but you probably take that if you're the A's, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't know if it's going to be enough if he pitches that well. If they'll be able to do enough to try to capture the American League West. I still would put my money on the Astros. They're 5.5 games ahead, and I really do think that the Mariners are going to be able to hold out and capture that last wild card spot. But you've been talking up the Athletics for a little while now, and I think that you've been right on from the start of the season about this team being more competitive than me or perhaps others would have expected.
Yeah, but at the same time, my National League dark horse was the New York Mets. So let's not give me too much credit here for being a soothsayer or, psychic or whatever, because, sometimes you hit a double in the A's and sometimes you strike out and throw your bat and somehow it hits yourself in the head. And that's what I did with the Mets pick. So one for two, maybe, depending on what the A's do the rest of the way. I'll take it, though. That's not too awful, I guess.
I know this isn't part of our normal talking point, but since I brought up the Mariners, have you heard that the Mariners are trying out Robinson Cano at third base in prep for his eventual comeback to the team?
Yeah, and first base. They're giving him experience all over. And that's just a weird situation, and it's just weird to me how they're handling this. Like, yes, he's not going to be eligible for the postseason. And sure, you want D. Gordon to get as many reps back at second base as you can. But Their handling of Dee Gordon has been pretty weird, right? Like, he's still batting at the top of their order despite having like a 303 on base percentage, it looks like. Like, he's arguably one of their worst hitters, and they're still batting him leadoff. Like, he doesn't even have 10 walks this season. He's just, I don't know. It's a very weird situation.
Jeff Sullivan of Fangraphs had some good tweets about D. Gordon's inability to take a walk yesterday, where he was talking about how D. Gordon has 7 walks for the season and Juan Soto has 7 walks since Thursday. You know, just ridiculous stuff like that. I don't know what's going on with the D. Gordon thing. You know, teams value having speed at the top of the lineup, but Gordon has not been good, so I don't know what exactly they're doing there and why they would want to make room for him and shift, you know, a guy who's going to be ostensibly part of this Mariners team for the next 5 years, around like that.
Right, and yeah, I don't know. It's just a weird handling. And of course, you know, batting lineups, you know, they don't matter as much as maybe we focus on them. But it's just a whole weird situation. I really don't know what to make of it. And I don't know. Yeah, I guess we probably won't be talking about the Mariners in the postseason anyway at this rate. So I guess it'll all be for naught anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still thinking they got it, but we'll wait and see. But we'll move on to some other moves now. You mentioned a little bit about the Nationals and their surprising, you know, cutting ties with Sean Kelly. They made another move to replace him in the bullpen, and it's not exactly what I would have expected. It was they've signed Greg Holland, who was cut loose by the Cardinals as part of their bullpen remodel in St. Louis. And they've signed Greg Holland to a contract, and he's already gotten his first taste of action with the Nationals. What do you think about this? This was surprising to me because I kind of thought Holland might have been a fit for the Nationals in the offseason. Now he ends up there eventually, but not exactly carrying the same cachet that he did in the offseason.
Right, he was terrible with the Cardinals, got off to a bad start, and at the time, I kind of credited that to the weird offseason, you know, signing late and all that stuff, but it really didn't seem like he got a whole lot better. And when you look at his, you know, pitch data and all that, he's been not so great on levels beyond the surface. I mean, his swinging strike rate per swing on his four-seam fastball was 20% last season. It's halved to 10% this year, which would be a career low, it seems like. His slider is missing fewer bats. You know, he's never been a guy who you necessarily think of as like a command artist or anything like that. He has the funky delivery, and I don't know, it just doesn't seem like a guy who you want to really bank on pitching, you know, medium to high leverage situations for your club, especially when you're trying to get back into the race. But at the same time, I'm not really sure it makes a big difference whether you have Sean Kelly there or Greg Holland. And if you think there's something that you can help him with, well, I mean, maybe they can basically be the same guy going forward. I don't know. It's just a weird decision. I'd probably rather have Kelly than Holland at this point, but I'm not sure it's really a big deal for the Nationals, provided Davey Martinez doesn't use him in situations that he should not be used in.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. I think they're just trying to get some potential value. If they can figure out something with him, then maybe they can work to re-sign him in the offseason and do something in order to try to make him a fixture for 2019. His first outing obviously went about as well as you could have expected. He struck out 3 out of the 4 batters he faced, gave up a walk with the other one. But the real concern with Holland, I think, has been once he got to St. Louis, that strikeout rate dipped. And in addition to that, the walk rate shot up to he was walking as many guys as he struck out. With guys like that who, you know, have always kind of had a certain level of performance, and then a change of scenery might just be enough for a guy like Holland. But you kind of got the impression from watching him in St. Louis that he might have been in his own head a little bit, thanks to that awful start that he got off to.
Yeah, and at the same time, he only threw 60% strikes. And if you look at his career, he's usually around the league average mark, you know, 63 plus percent. And yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Obviously, Derek Liljeqvist has his work cut out for him there. And that bullpen, man, it looked like a strength at one point for the Nationals. And now it's Kelvin Herrera, Ryan Madsen, Justin Miller, who a lot of people probably don't even know exist, Sammy Solis, Matt Grace, Greg Holland, and then Wander Suero, I think is how I pronounce that. And, you know, they have Joaquin Benoit. He hasn't pitched all season for them. And they also have Sean Doolittle working his way back from toe inflammation. But even when that group is healthy, that's not a really deep and strong group like it used to be, right?
No, not at all. And although when it's healthy, I mean, Sean Doolittle's been phenomenal this year, and I think he makes all the difference in the world because it looks a lot different when you have the pairing of Doolittle and Herrera at the back end of the bullpen compared to Herrera and Ryan Madsen. I feel like, although Madsen's been quite good over the last couple of weeks, I do think there's a big difference there. Do you wonder if the Nationals' strategy of trying to rebuild the 2015 Royals bullpen, bit by bit, is something that might have been done on purpose? Do you think that they might find that Holland's a good investment for them because, maybe pairing him with Herrera will, recapture some of that old magic, or do you think that wasn't really a consideration?
I just can't imagine that's a consideration. But if they go out there and get Aaron Crow next, then we'll know for sure that yes, there's
Former
something weird going on.
Washington National Aaron Crow, no less. So that would be really weird.
Oh man, he just kind of disappeared too. I know he got hurt after he traded to, or before he traded to Miami, and then that was the last we ever seen from him. I don't even know if he's pitched in the minors any recently. So.
I thought I saw his name pop up at some point. He hasn't pitched. He only pitched a few innings in rookie ball in 2016. I thought I saw his name in an independent league update at some point, but yeah, I'm not up on my Crow. So that
Oh
was
my
your
God.
what? It's
That
not
was
that bad. Come
bad.
on,
But
man.
he's pitching in Mexico, or he was pitching in Mexico, and he was not doing well. So it does seem like we've seen the last of Aaron Crow. And you know who else was on his team?
In Mexico or in.
Yes.
No, I don't.
Yes, Mexico. Desmond Jennings, Grant Green, Ruben Rivera. Yes, that Ruben Rivera. Chad Gaudin, Ernesto Fieri, Phil Koch, Aaron Laffey, and Josh Lukey. So wow, what a
That's a
and
weird.
Jerome Williams. What a collection of names.
With Desmond Jennings and Grant Green, it's like the all guys that I touted but never worked out team from like 2014. So good on them for it sounds like they've got somebody who's a shadow me running that roster, with the exception of Josh Lukey, who I would have fired, preferably out of a cannon.
Speaking of guys who used to be hyped but never lived up to it performance-wise. The Pittsburgh Pirates made another trade this week with the Tampa Bay Rays. This time, they did not acquire a Chris Archer-like talent. They instead acquired a Danny Etcheverria in exchange for a minor league right-hander named Matt Selinger. They also claimed Buddy Bochers. Well, since we said Buddy Bochers' name, off waivers from the Astros. Etcheverria seems like he's there to kind of serve as an insurance policy and perhaps as a utility infielder. They didn't really give up much here. Selinger is another member of their 2017 draft class because, the Rays didn't already acquire enough of those guys from them. He is a short right-hander, a reliever who's given up like 1.5 home runs per nine. He does have an impressive strikeout rate, but the stuff is not as impressive as that strikeout rate would suggest. It's like a low 90s rising fastball in a curve that isn't lethal. So probably never going to see the light of a chop. At the same time, how do you think that Etcheverria helps the Pirates' chances of getting back into this wild card race, or do you think this is just a move that we'll all forget about in about 8 weeks' time?
I don't know if we're all going to forget about it because anytime Adeniyi Echevarria is traded, it seems to stick in your brain like like an open wound. I feel like this is not going to make any difference for the overall performance of the Pirates because I think they'd be crazy to play him regularly, especially ahead of Jordy Mercer, who's perfectly fine. The thing that kind of seems weird is it does seem to me like this move is a direct response to perhaps Sean Rodriguez getting injured, because I think Rodriguez was nominally their backup shortstop, which, again, never something you really want is to have Sean Rodriguez be your backup shortstop. He's just not good enough defensively to hold that position, but they really don't have a lot of AAA depth. At shortstop. So, it would have been probably a Kevin Newman coming up, which I actually think would have been a lot of fun.
That would have been fun.
I would much rather see Kevin Newman get reps at shortstop than Adeniyi Echevarria. I think Echevarria at this point is basically a net negative for any team, so it does not move the needle at all, and I don't really see why the Pirates did it.
Yeah, and Etcheverria can't hit. He is an above average fielder. You're right about Rodriguez going to the DL. I don't know, man. I don't know. They could have brought up Max Moroff. They could have brought up Chris Bostic, who they actually designated for assignment And you're right, they could have brought up Newman and given us a little bit of a different look there. But I guess I can understand not wanting to bring up Newman and then sitting him on the bench if you believe that he's not as good or better than Jordy Mercer is at this point. So, interesting situation. Of course, it's also interesting because Etcheverry is a free agent at season's end, the same way that Mercer is, I believe. So, it's not like they added a long-term fit here. They kind of added a guy who's literally going to sit on the bench for the most part for the next 8 weeks. And also, it's weird because Echeverria has not played a non-shortstop position in the majors since 2012. So it may literally have been 6 years since he played a position other than shortstop. Adding him as your utility infielder, I mean, you're basically adding him with the intent of only playing him at shortstop, right? Or do you think that getting him some reps at third base, second base, do you think that's even in the cards? Or do you think they're literally just thinking of him as a guy who's going to slot in at shortstop, maybe later in games?
Yeah, I don't think so at all. I think that their backup for David Freese and Colin Moran are your third baseman, depending on righty or lefty. So I don't feel like they really need a backup, especially with Adam Frazier on the roster at third or at second base. So yeah, I would say Echeverria is literally the 25th man on this roster, with only as a break glass in case of emergency, or give Jordy Mercer a day off at shortstop. I don't think he'll do anything else.
Makes sense to me. As for the Boshers part of this deal, he had not made a major league appearance this season. However, in 41 games for the Astros Triple A team, he struck out nearly 10 per 9, had walked fewer than 3 per 9. You've probably seen him around in the majors before. Pitched with the Angels and the Twins, 100 appearances, a 4.59 ERA, and over 3 strikeouts per walk. Low 90s fastball, slider guy. So I don't know. We'll probably see him in September or perhaps before then, depending on how highly the Pirates do value him. It's worth noting that they only have one left-hander in their bullpen, that being closer Felipe Vasquez. So maybe they see him as a guy who could conceivably give him another look out of the bullpen as a left-hander. But time will tell on that front. So I think we can probably move on from the Pirates part of this to a more interesting set of deals that involved the San Diego Padres, because the Padres allowed two different pitchers to go on, excuse me, to leave via waiver without asking for anything in return. And those pitchers were Tyson Ross, who went to the Cardinals, and Jordan Lyles, who went to the Brewers. Were you surprised at all that they just let these guys go?
Yes, I was surprised. Tyson Ross is due, I think, a grand total of $2 million if he's going to remain in a Major League Baseball rotation for the rest of the season, which he deserves to do. He has not been great this year, but he's been serviceable enough that, with his 4.45 ERA, he should be able to, be of value to some team as an everyday starter. But I think if he were going to start out the rest of the season for the Padres, they would have ended up paying him, I think, $500,000 worth of base salary plus something like $200,000 per start that he would have made. I don't know why the Padres necessarily, I mean, I know why the Padres decided to save money by cutting ties with him. I don't think that was probably worth the amount of money that they saved to make this move. When it comes to Jordan Lyles, he obviously was not going to be part of this team's future, and he was not as good at as Tyson Ross in the intermediate time. As a matter of fact, he has never had a season in Major League Baseball, with one exception, his rookie year in 2011, where he's been above replacement level according to Baseball Prospectus's metrics. So to me, the question isn't so much why did the Padres give up Jordan Lyles for nothing? It was why was Jordan Lyles employed to begin with, for any other reason other than as a emergency break glass in case of emergency type of pitcher.
Let me try to answer that. So, for starters, Lyles is still pretty young. He's 27, about to turn 28. He has a cheap club option for next season. He has been homer prone this season, but when you look at his strikeout to walk ratio, it's actually a lot better than any other mark throughout his career. It would be a career best, even 3.26, which not great, but fine. And the interesting thing about Jordan Lyles, in my estimation, is that he has gained not only fastball velocity in recent years, but he has gained a vertical rise on his fastball. And according to Brooks Baseball, over the last 2 seasons, his fastball rises about 9 inches or so. Before that, he had never top nine, and the closest he had gotten was 8.86. Otherwise, it was in the sevens to mid eight range. Now, I don't know, man. Maybe that's nothing. It certainly hasn't necessarily led to more whiffs or substantially better performance, but maybe the Brewers think, hey, we can bring this guy in here. Maybe we can alter how he uses his fastball, and, you know, perhaps we can get a competent, cheap reliever for basically the cost of a waiver claim and whatever. I think his option's worth like $3 million or whatever, but it wouldn't surprise me if maybe they see something in his pitch data or whatever, and they expect they can exploit that in ways that maybe the Padres were not able to do. Because I think if you look at the Padres, they seem to like pitching down in the zone, or at least, you know, for the most part. I know there are exceptions. For instance, our old friend Kyle McGrath, he loved pitching up in the zone, which was always funny because he was like a, you know, slop throwing left-hander, and you wouldn't expect him of all people to do it. But the point is, I think maybe the Brewers see something here, and it wouldn't surprise me if we actually talk about this as a decent enough acquisition, you know, 8 weeks' time, because maybe they unlock something that we didn't think Jordan Lyles even had.
I mean, that's always possible. I just am very down on Lyles. I mean, we've seen him convert into the bullpen this year. He spent a lot of time in the bullpen this year and last year, especially with Colorado. And we didn't see any improvement in terms of his ability to generate strikeouts out of the bullpen. We haven't really seen much in terms of his ability to limit homers out of the bullpen. So I just don't hold out a lot of hope. But yeah, if a team's going to fix him, the Brewers are probably as good a chance as any, especially considering the fact that they can afford to let him practice in the major league bullpen and see if something can come of it, given that they have so much other talent in that bullpen.
Yeah, and also Derek Johnson is a great pitching coach based on reputation, and he wrote a book a few years back. And if you're into the art of pitching or anything like that, I would recommend it because it has all kinds of cool little videos and drills and stuff. And let's put it this way. He had me throwing strikes in my backyard after I read his book, and that is quite the accomplishment. So I think very highly of Johnson. And he has an interesting story too, because he was the pitching coach at Vanderbilt. And, you know, you don't usually see collegiate coaches rise the ranks as quickly as he did. He was with the Cubs organization for a few years, and then he went to Milwaukee. So very interesting, and hopefully for Jordan Lyles' sake, his reputation proves correct in this instance, and he can unlock a little bit more than we've led to believe was in Jordan Lyles.
So how do you feel about the Tyson Ross acquisition for the Cardinals? It looks like there's a chance that he's only going to be used in relief now, which is really a bummer for Ross, I feel like, because I do think he's probably got a little more upside than, like, I don't know, Austin Gomber or John Gant, if you were looking to win games immediately. And by putting him in the bullpen, of course, the Cardinals don't have to pay those incentives on his contract either. So,
you know, it was a little weird because I didn't really assume the Cardinals would be adding anyone who could conceivably be around only for the next 8 weeks. At the same time, though, I guess it's fine. I mean, Ross's performance as of late has really ticked off, and you know, maybe they just think that his future's in the bullpen anyway. You look at him now, potentially he'd be open to re-signing and being a middle reliever or a setup man, depending on how the stuff plays, and that'll be that. I do agree that, you know, Ross is probably better than John Gant. Austin Gomber, I've always been kind of interested in, dating back to his prospect days, so I'm not sure I'm ready to say Ross is better than Gomber, but yeah, I don't know. It's a weird arrangement. I wonder almost if the Cardinals are hoping they can have Ross pitch so well over the next few weeks that they can then spin him off right before August 31st to some contender or some team who desires him more. Remember a few years back with the Juan Nicasio situation where the Pirates got rid of him? I believe it was the Phillies who picked him up, and then they spun him to the Cardinals a couple weeks later, and it was just like, I don't think anything came of the guy they got back, but still, pretty creative. And also, while we're on the topic of these moves, I wanted to know, the Brewers claimed Ariel Hernandez as well, and he's probably not someone a lot of people are familiar with. He throws very, very hard. Brooks baselines his velocity and his appearances at 98 miles per hour for his fastball. He also has a curveball that goes 88 miles per hour and a changeup that goes 90 miles per hour. So he's not a finesse guy whatsoever, and it'll be interesting to see if they can get something from him as well.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. I know the Dodgers always have these kind of waiver crunches to give up these guys, but I was kind of surprised that he popped loose and that he fell all the way to the Brewers able to make a waiver claim on him. So that's pretty cool.
And speaking of guys who, well, they're going to be on waivers. The Indians designated Zach McAllister for assignment to activate Andrew Miller. McAllister actually been pretty solid last year, even good, I would say. And he's a pending free agent, so it's kind of wild to think that he's went from a guy who could conceivably get a multi-year deal this winter as a reliever to a guy who is going to be available on waivers for whoever wants him. And, you know, I don't really know what went wrong with his season because the velocity is still there. The stuff, if you look at, you know, through the PitchFX lens, it still looks good. It just, like, I don't know, he just never got going. And now I'm kind of curious to see if he's even going to land with a team for the rest of the year or if he'll take the next 8 weeks off and then just try to reestablish his value as a, you know, on a 1 year deal next year. I don't know. What do you think?
I think he'll definitely catch on somewhere because I think between his combination of, you know, like you said, there's not a lot in his scouting profile that shows like, oh, something really bad has happened. So I think it would be very smart for a team that is looking to maybe fill in just an extra bullpen slot. Some team like the Mets, some team like, you know, one of these other teams that maybe is a little bit out of contention. The Marlins, somebody that needs a live arm in the bullpen, could give him a shot. And I think it behooves McAllister to find a place where he can, you know, hopefully, unless he's really not betting on himself, where he can hopefully reestablish a little bit of value and have a strong finish to the season to show off when he's looking to get a major league contract this offseason, as opposed to having to come in on a non-roster invite or something.
Yeah, that's fair. And yeah, it just seems like his fastball really got hit around, which tends to mean location issues. So I don't know, maybe there's a mechanical tweak that needs to happen there or something along those lines, because if you look at his career since he's became a reliever, he's been really good. I think I understated it earlier because in 2015, he had a 144 ERA plus. In 2016, a 132. Last year, a 178. And then this year, it's down to 90. Home run rate is as high as it's ever been. Walk rate, still pretty low. Actually, it looks like a career best, but the strikeout rate has dipped with it. So, I don't know. He's an interesting guy. He's only 30 years old, so I assume we have not seen the last of him in the majors, and I assume we haven't seen the last of him as a productive big league reliever, excuse me, but very curious times for him to get shunned, like I said, because, you know, some of the other Indians relievers had also struggled this season, so you could have made a case that maybe they should have gotten rid of Dan Otero or one of these other guys. So for them to go and just get rid of McAllister instead of even like faking a DL stint, that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. I definitely agree with you. I mean, there's only so much you can do in terms of faking DL stints, and quite honestly, I'm kind of happy if the Indians front office is choosing not to do that, because I do feel like it's a little bit abusive to the system. But I'm kind of with you. Usually when you've got an asset you want to hang on to, you hang on to that asset. So they might have seen something in his profile that they just don't like anymore.
Yep, and speaking of profiles that we just don't like anymore, the Angels designated for assignment Luis Valbuena to promote Deck McGuire. That is not the saddest sentence we'll say all episode, but it's pretty close to it. Valbuena had been horrible this year, hitting 199, 253, 335 in 96 games. That results in a 61 OPS plus. If a guy's not hitting, he's probably not going to add much value to your roster, so hit the open market here soon as a 32-year-old who has not been a league average or better hitter since 2016. Is this the last we'll ever see of Luis Valbuena in the major leagues?
No, I don't think so. I think a lefty bat who can play some corners, who's got a little bit of pop still. I mean, there's a certainly a non-zero chance that he gets an NRI with some team. It would shock me absolutely 0% to see him as the opening day third baseman for the Orioles next year or something like that, as a fill-in for a team that's rebuilding. And if he can prove that he can get things back together a little bit, you know, with a good spring training behind him or something like that, I think he'll get another shot at it. But for the Angels, I find this really interesting, simply because it looks like then with Valbuena out of the picture, well, first of all, that means that they won't be platooning Albert Pujols at all, which is always kind of an interesting choice, but Pujols has really come back quite a bit this year in terms of his offense, which is nice. He doesn't need a caddy the same way that he did in previous seasons, I don't feel like. But this does mean that it looks like Caleb Cowart's going to get every possible chance to succeed or fail for the end of the season. Obviously, David Fletcher's pretty ensconced at second base for the time being. They called up also Jose Miguel Fernandez, who's a not at all a prospect type of player from AAA. So I think that the Angels are just interested in seeing which of these guys that they have that are younger and team-controlled or younger or team-controlled might be a part of this team for the foreseeable future, at least for 2019, when Valbuena obviously isn't.
And the answer is probably none of the above. So they'll probably be in the market for a new third baseman and perhaps a new second baseman, depending on David Fletcher and what he's able to do over the ensuing weeks. But I think my favorite thing about Caleb Cowart is that his middle name is Bryant. So if you're an Angels fan and you get down, just remember that your third baseman is technically K. Bryant, even if it's not that K. Bryant. Otherwise, there's just not a lot of positives to find in this situation right now.
I don't think the Angels will be looking for a second baseman next year, because I do think that when Zach Cozart's going to come off his surgery, and given it being shoulder surgery, I'm not sure they'll put him back at third base. They may want to move him to second, but I do think he'll be able to take some time and recover and be a part of this Angels infield. But they're going to have to do something one of those two positions, either second or third.
Yeah, and I misspoke when I said and second base. Yeah, one or the other. Or, again, it's conceivable they go with Fletcher at second base. Although, I don't know, if Socha's not there, maybe they will not be as held to Fletcher's high contact ways. I don't know. Again, this is a messy situation, and that roster looks as weak and as death-free as we thought it was entering the season. If they suffered injuries, they were toast, and unfortunately they suffered so many injuries that they are indeed toast at this point.
So while we're on the subject of the Angels, can we talk briefly about a call-up that they had? When they traded Ian Kinsler to the Red Sox, the big, and I'm using air quotes for that, the big return was Williams Jerez, pitcher, who they've now brought up to the major leagues, and he's made his debut with Anaheim, his major league debut. Didn't exactly cover himself in glory, but he did prevent any runs from scoring, throwing two innings of relief for the Angels. How do you feel about Jerez? Are you excited to see him get a chance? Is he the type of pitcher you have some interest in, being a lefty without absolutely wipeout stuff? How do you feel about him?
I don't feel any particular way about him. Yeah, he is a tallish lefty. I don't know. Is he supposed to inspire anything to me? Because I always thought of him as more like a middle relief prospect who wasn't going to wow you with his stuff or anything like that. And isn't he a converted position player? I don't know. Maybe I have the wrong guy in mind here, but I always thought I'm connecting him with a converted. I don't know. We'll have to look that up. But
he is a converted outfielder. So yes.
There we go. Okay. So I know some stuff about Williams Perez. No. I don't know. He doesn't do a whole lot for me. Is he supposed to? Convince me that I'm supposed to really care about William Perez either way.
I can't. The only thing that I can tell you is that in the minor leagues this year, he finally popped his strikeout rate to the levels that you would expect for a guy who's going to come up and actually relieve in the big leagues. He, in 52 innings in Pawtucket this year, just miles away from where I am right now, he had an 11.9 strikeout rate, K per nine. So that's something that'll play in the major leagues, I think. He is not much other than a fastball guy, but he does have the ability to throw multiple innings in relief. Like I mentioned, he threw two innings in relief for Anaheim. He threw 52 relief innings in just 34 appearances when he was with Pawtucket. So if you're looking for a guy, and in the past he's done this too, he's basically a two-inning reliever. That makes him a little bit more interesting to me, though I don't think he'll actually be good.
Yeah, and I just watched the video for because I wanted to refresh, and it looks like a guy who could conceivably do some damage against lefties. He has a short arm action, kind of a sidearm slot. So I don't know. Maybe they'll use him as a multi-inning reliever. Maybe he'll just be a left-handed specialist. I will say, to Anaheim's credit, or to Los Angeles' credit, wow, I am all over the place right now. To Billy Epler's credit, he has done well in the past and covering some interesting relief types. So maybe they see something there and they think that, he could be a contributor. Maybe he's eventually Jose Alvarez's replacement. But yeah, I've never had strong feelings about Jerez, and I don't think there's any reason to have strong feelings about him based on what I'm seeing and what I've Red and all. So yeah, at least he's a new name, I guess. So
Yeah, and the Angels are going to need a few of those guys going forward. So speaking of some other new names in the American League West, the Rangers have picked up three pitchers of varying degree of awfulness, let's say. They've signed Drew Hutchinson, Chris Tillman, and then they also claimed Zach Curtis off waivers from the Phillies. Do you think any of these three pitchers are going to make a difference for this Rangers team, or is this just late summer roster shuffling to try to get some innings eaten for the Rangers?
well, I think you can say Tillman's absolutely going to make a difference for them if they're trying to pursue a better draft pick and they actually give them meaningful innings. But if we're talking about a positive impact, I'm still hoping that Drew Hutchinson can get it going. I mean, he pitched fine to well with the Dodgers and the minors, and he's still pretty young. And I know his stint with the Phillies was pretty much unremarkable. Didn't throw a lot of strikes, certainly got lit up with his mistakes. I don't know. He's in his age 27 season. He debuted pretty young as a, I think it was 21, 22-year-old. And it looked like for a time there, he could develop into a mid-rotation starter. That trade to Pittsburgh, we all were like, oh, wow, that's an interesting return. Pittsburgh will fix him up. And Pittsburgh did not fix him up. Instead, he made like a handful of appearances for their big league club, and that was it. That said, I don't think it's likely that he's going to be good for them. With Zach Curtis, he's a little left-hander, and he might be too little. He's like 5'9". You just don't see a lot of guys that short succeed at this level. That said, he's shown some ability in the minors to miss bats, and he's also a little wild. So I don't know. I don't think it's likely that any of these guys is going to be more than a stand-in for the next 8 weeks or whatever. And we'll probably forget they were all there in 10 weeks on.
Yeah, I really think that Tillman is broken beyond repair. I don't see him having any success, and he's not even on the 40 man for this Rangers team. So I think this is just a let's try to get him some reps in the minor leagues and see if we can fix him, but it's probably not going to happen. With Curtis, I feel pretty indifferent to him. I'll be interested to see if they actually give him a chance in the bullpen for any extended period, but right now he's not on the 25-man roster either, so I'm not sure if he's going to get much run for the rest of 2018, which leaves Hutchison, who, let's just say, his first start with the Rangers didn't go as planned. It's the Baltimore Orioles, who we rag on all the time about being terrible, and he only managed to make it 3 innings against the Orioles while giving up 2 homers, 6 earned runs, and walking 3 guys while striking out nobody in his Rangers debut. Not exactly auspicious. Not at all anything you wanted to see. And yet the Rangers are so deprived of pitching talent, he'll be making a start next Saturday against the Yankees.
That's gonna go poorly.
Yeah, I'm afraid that it is too. I'm really concerned about that, especially, it doesn't matter if he's pitching in Texas or in New York for that game. That's not a great position to be in. So I feel nervous about Hutchison. I really hope he has a great outing and he's able to turn things around, but his time with Philadelphia did not go all that well this year. He was basically used as an emergency swing man for that team, and he had one wonderful 5-inning outing against the Nationals back in May. Since then, things didn't go so great. He had some decent pitching in the minor leagues, like you said, but while I continue to have hope for him, he is now finishing out his age 27 season. He'll be 28 next year, and he looks like an NRI guy for the future.
Yeah, and it could be worse. He could have been signed 30 minutes before the game and then thrown in there for a relief appearance, the way the next transaction we had to talk about was. The Blue Jays signed Mike Hochschild, apparently literally within like an hour before the game, and he just went out and threw 6 innings relief, all shutout innings, 4 hits, a walk, 5 strikeouts. Kind of impressive. It's funny because he is only 28 years old, but if you compared his pitcher to Drew Hutchinson, you would think he was at least 5 or so years older. And then he's also from Beaver Creek High School, which is just a great high school name. So Mike Hochschild, probably not someone you're familiar with, probably not someone you need to be familiar with, but a pretty cool story all the same.
Yeah, the Blue Jays have kind of a history of doing this, where they I think it was Chris Rowley a couple of years ago. Yep. They tend to pull these guys out of nowhere and give them great stories, and then eventually it turns out that they're exactly what we thought they would be in terms of pitching talent, which is up and down Triple A, Quad A type of pitchers. So it'll be interesting to see if he can hold up. Unfortunately, his next attempt has to be against the Red Sox today. He's starting against the Red Sox today, which good luck. That's a tough pull.
Man, the scheduling gods are just not in favor of these guys. Giving Hutchinson the Yankees, albeit a beat-up Yankees team, and then giving Hochschild the Red Sox. I mean, God bless him. JD Martinez is going to hit a ball to Beaver Creek if he's not careful.
Yeah, that's very, very good point. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that works out. But I too, am rooting for Hochschild. Obviously, it's better than letting Jaime Garcia run out in that rotation spot, because he's been pretty rough this year. So it'll be fun to see him get a chance and maybe earn a spot and at least a bullpen for next year.
It's wild, too, because we were both high on that Garcia move when it happened. Yeah. You're right. He's been really bad to the point where his demotion to the bullpen, like, it wasn't like you even could object to it because,
It's kind of interesting because there were a lot of these short-term, relatively inexpensive, I thought, free agent signings, Lance Lynn, Alex Cobb, Jaime Garcia, that I was all for this offseason, and it just didn't seem like major league teams were as high on them as I was, or as a lot of the sabermetric orthodoxy was. And boy, as a group, those short-term deals where guys didn't get contracts that we thought would be as expensive or as long-term or even as early in the offseason as we thought, almost to a man, they seem to have worked out pretty poorly.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because Shapiro is the one who made this deal, and you would think that, if there were statistical reasons not to want these guys, or in this case Garcia, that he would have avoided that, especially, it did require spending some money. It wasn't like he got him for $1 million or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't really know what to make of that. I don't know how much of that is just us trying to see a pattern there, or if there were some reasons behind the scenes to be hesitant. I will say, the Orioles, giving Alex Cobb that 4-year deal does look a little regrettable in retrospect, but I have to hope that Cobb will get it turned around and we won't be talking about him in the same regards. And also, Lynn has been pretty good since joining the Yankees, too. So maybe it's just a matter of fit and timing and stuff that maybe we're not fully capable of assessing heading into a deal or heading into a signing. I don't know. I'm trying to think of any reason here beyond the team fall stuffing that we did, because that's such a boring explanation.
That's very true. That is very true. So our last important move, I would say, as far as a player changing teams, is the Diamondbacks designating for assignment Devin Marrero instead of bringing him off the DL. With the addition of Eduardo Escobar, even with Jake Lamb undergoing surgery, it looks like the Diamondbacks have a certain level of tolerance for infielders who can't hit at all. And so Marrero will be packing up his bags and going somewhere else. What are your thoughts on Devin Marrero?
I mean, he can't hit. That's about all you can say about him. And he'll still probably latch on somewhere, don't you think, as a utility infielder? Like, if the Pirates had just claimed Marrero off waivers, that probably would have made just as much sense as going out there and trading anything for Echeverria, right?
Yeah, I do think so. Although Devin Marrero makes Edeni Echeverria look like Bryce Harper at the plate. We talk about, Echeverria's complete lack of pop. This year, Devin Marrero has been almost singularly awful with the bat. He has a triple slash line of 167, 224, 205, which is, the Mendoza line has nothing on that. That's a 16 weighted runs created plus. And truthfully, it's not that far off his career numbers, which is just devastating. He has a career 197, 250, 283 triple slash over what's now 343 big league appearances. He can pick it, and that's great, but he's basically a pitcher at the plate.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because, I don't know, when you think of these bad hitters, you kind of think, at least for middle infielders, you think of guys who maybe put the ball in play a lot, don't draw walks, but also don't strike out a lot, and that's not the case here at all. I mean, he draws an okay amount of walks, but he really has issues making contact. I think his contact rate is around 70%. which is just pitiful for a guy who does not hit for any power whatsoever. Hits a fair amount of infield flies, which, again, not something you want to see out of this profile. So, yeah, I mean, bless his heart. Hopefully he does latch on to someone's utility infielder, but he just can't hit.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it is unfortunate. And, you know, the Diamondbacks, as we've established in the past, when they run Nick Ahmed out there, Chris Owings, Ketel Marte to some extent, you know, they don't necessarily need to have a guy who can hit 300 at these middle infield spots, but pretty much everybody else that they've got on their 25-man, their 40-man, and in most of their upper minors levels can hit better than Marrero can.
I think you might be able to hit better than Marrero can, honestly.
Let me tell you, as somebody who finally in his in a softball game in his 35th year of life finally hit his first on the fly home run, you are certainly wrong. 100% wrong about that.
This reminds me of Jason Tyner when he hit his first home run. He said it was his first home run ever, that he didn't even hit a home run in Little League. And that's my second favorite Jason Tyner fun fact. My favorite Jason Tyner fun fact is that his middle name is his last name, Tyner, spelled backward.
Really? That's fascinating. I thought I knew everything about Jason Tyner, and I certainly do not.
That's why people listen to the show, Brian.
I unfortunately, you may be right. That may be why people listen to this show.
I know why they don't listen to the show, and that's because we don't talk enough about Colby Allard, who got promoted from the minor leagues for a spot start with the Braves. He is a pretty interesting prospect. I remember him back in his draft year. Athletic left-hander. I think there might have been Scott Kazmir comparisons at one point, but unfortunately for Allard, and I said his major league debut, I believe he's actually appeared twice now, and I don't think they've gone well, because in seven innings he's only struck out two. He has a 10.29 ERA, but he is one of the Braves' highest regarded prospects. Highest regarded prospects, and I assume we'll be seeing more of Mr. Allard in the future. Probably be seeing more of Mr. Allard in a good way in the future. So do you have any other thoughts on his promotion and what he could offer to this Braves team down the stretch and in the future?
Well, down the stretch, I'm not sure. I really can't be too sure about this. You know, it seems like every time the Braves have called somebody up recently, they've at least had some modicum of success. And Allard's got the background to be able to be a successful major league starting pitcher sooner rather than later. I'm just not 100% sure that, given his strikeout rate in the minor leagues this year, if he's really ready to step in and be a contributor right away now. I think he might need a little more minor league seasoning. That having been said, I mean, he's probably not going to be considerably worse than some of these other guys. And if they use him in kind of a relief role, that could be really interesting, I think. You know, the lack of velocity is a little concerning, but maybe they give him some shorter outings. Maybe he can pop some velocity a little bit and be a weapon in the bullpen, which could keep them in contention for that National League East win, or if nothing else, he could be something somewhat useful in the playoffs.
Yeah, the velocity is concerning because he is a little lefty, but you know, I think he was around 89 miles per hour, which is not what you want to see. Well, that's a Joe Girardi quote, but it's true here. And I guess the appeal of him is in part that he can throw strikes, and also that he has a pair of average or better secondaries in his curveball, and I think his changeup is his best regarded pitch. So going to be interesting to see what his future holds, because this is not a guy who, despite being 20 years old, is really projectable or figures to add a whole lot to his raw stuff. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting profile to watch. And, you know, the Braves have a number of arms who are a little bit better off, or, you know, project a little bit better. And Mike Soroka was one of those guys, and we might not even be having this discussion if he had found a way to stay healthy, because he seemed like a little bit of a better prospect, you know, more of a traditional starter's build and whatnot. So I don't know. I'm curious to see what happens for Allard heading forward. And I do think, though, that he'll perform better than he has to date, which, again, two appearances, so who really cares? And I think our last move, so to speak, of the day involves Johnny Cueto. One of my favorite pitchers, I believe, is one of your favorite pitchers as well. he's going to miss the next year due to Tommy John surgery, and that is just all kinds of depressing. And why did we end on such a sad note here, Brian?
Well, we ended on the sad note because it's the one injury, I think, recently that is probably the most affecting for a team. Yeah, it's certainly affecting for us because watching Johnny Cueto pitch is awesome. He is fun to watch. He is a good pitcher when he's a great pitcher when he's on. When he's off, he's still super fun to watch because he does so many things differently than most other starting pitchers. The Tommy John surgery is a real bummer. He seems like the type of guy who's going to be able to recover from that fine going forward, just because he's not a guy who relies entirely on his velocity. He's a guy who mixes things up anyways, so the initial lack of control maybe won't be a huge issue. The emergence of Derek Rodriguez kind of makes this an easier pill to swallow, I guess, if you're a San Francisco Giants fan. But that would also imply that Derek Rodriguez will continue to be good, and I don't know why that would be the case. So I guess the Giants have a history kind of like this, like a little bit like I mentioned of the Blue Jays, where they have these guys who are kind of pop-up dudes who come into the rotation, they pitch well for a short period, and then turn back into pumpkins. We saw it for a little while with guys like Chris Stratton in the past. I just don't know if he's going to hold on to being a usable starting pitcher, and if he doesn't, the Giants' rotation now, especially without Cueto, Jeff Samardzija has, of course, been injured with a shoulder injury for a while now. The 2019 Giants look to be questionable at best, with a lot of holes left on this team.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you mentioned Rodriguez. You didn't even mention Derek Holland, who has kind of had a resurgence as well on the staff. But I don't know. I don't think the Giants are going to make the postseason this year, and it also hurts them heading forward because Cueto is conceivably going to miss maybe all of next year, and then at that point we're talking about him having still 2 years left on his deal guaranteed. So you hope he does come back strong, just for the entertainment purposes, but also because, you know, it's good for him and it's vital to this Giants team. And I don't know. I don't really know what they're going to do this winter. They obviously are flirting with that luxury tax number. I'm kind of surprised that they haven't dumped some more salary overboard in order to get underneath that number. And maybe that's still coming, because I keep in my head roster banning Andrew McCutchen to Cleveland right before August 31st passes. And wouldn't that be a fun little collection of talent there with McCutchen, Jay Ram, Lindor? You'd have some of the, you know, obviously some of the better players in the league, but also some of the most likable players in the league all in one spot. So that'd be kind of cool, but I don't know how likely that is to happen. And yeah, this roster is just not all that inspiring heading forward, is it?
No, it really isn't. And I think, you know, some of that has to do with the disappointment that, you know, I really was hoping that Evan Longoria would have a bounce back season this year. I would not say that that's been the case. He's been fine, and he's been very hot recently, but it was not, I think, what Giants fans were hoping for as the best possible scenario. It'll be interesting to see some of these younger guys, and now that they've got some time to play, Steven Duggar, Austin Slater, Derek Rodriguez, Andrew Suarez, some of these guys will get the opportunity to see if they'll be part of the next good Giants team. I just don't think the next good Giants team is coming until the next decade.
Well, geez, that was mean.
I don't think it's mean. There's only a couple of years left in the decade.
Yeah, you're right. I guess I was thinking, when you say next decade, I guess I'm thinking like, oh, it's going to be a 5-plus year rebuilding project like we're seeing in Kansas City and Baltimore and some of these other towns. So I'm thinking like, oh, wow, you mean like later, you know, 7-8 years down the road. But no, I guess that's fair to say, if you mean literally the next decade as in 2 to 3 years away, that's probably
I think they're 2 or 3 years not harsh.
There you go. So that's where we ended on, agreeing that, you know, this Giants team could be in trouble, and also talking about how some teams realistically probably will not be competitive until another 5 or 6 years have passed. So, man, we are just not a cheerful bunch here, even though we just agreed that August baseball is better than September baseball.
I think we can get excited for some potential August moves. Like you mentioned, McCutchen, he's playing so well, man. I would love to see him on a team that's going to give him some shine, especially after playing for so long with Pittsburgh and now moving over to the Giants when the Giants are having a down season. Cleveland would be absolutely perfect. I have no idea why that hasn't been something that's actually happened so far. I do kind of have a little bit of concern if he would make it through waivers. He's playing so well, and he's so popular.
That's a fair point. Maybe I don't know. Maybe Atlanta would try to claim him. I don't know. There's, you know, because you go through the NL first, then you go through the AL. But Cleveland, I would note, has or would have the worst record among AL playoff teams. So, you know, there's not a situation where a team ahead of them, because of the way the AL is, would be likely to block them. So maybe they'll end up being a landing spot for someone like Cole Calhoun or another free agent to be outfielder who becomes available from an American League team. But, yeah, it's going to be an interesting few weeks. And, you know, the Tigers probably are not done. I would guess that they're going to try to move Lariano or, you know, whoever else they can. I don't know. I would assume Lariano will be on the move. And I know Shane Green had some interest in him before the trade deadline. I don't know how likely that is either because, you know, you do have to pass through waivers. He's seemingly having kind of a down year if you look at his raw stats. I don't know. It'll be an interesting few weeks, and hopefully we do have some interesting moves to talk about. And I do think Holland will get moved. And maybe they even dump someone like Sam Dyson and just, again, try to get underneath that luxury tax number. So I don't think the Giants are done. I just think they're waiting until their playoff pitcher has evaporated, so to speak.
Do you think Cincinnati moves on from any of their players post the deadline? They do have a couple of expensive assets. And no, I'm not talking about Joey Votto, so don't get excited for anything like that, anyone who's listening. But they do have, you know, Homer Bailey has been pitching well over the last couple of weeks. He could be a guy.
That's not going to happen, is it?
I wouldn't think so, but I mean, I could see something possibly working out if the Reds were willing to eat a lot of that contract. And then there's also Billy Hamilton, who had been rumored for quite a bit and seems like the type of guy who would really have some interest to a playoff contending team looking for some speed at the end of the, during the playoffs or something like that. I mean, he could really be a difference maker in the playoffs, and he's not had a chance to do that in his career yet.
Yeah, I would expect Matt Harvey to go somewhere. And I would also think that Jared Hughes and or David Hernandez can find their ways to other teams, both of them. Again, it just amazes me how bad this Reds team has been. I know they played, you know, pretty well under Jim Riggleman, but if you think about it, imagine being told that they would get more than 100 innings of sub-2 ERA from Jared Hughes and David Hernandez, and that it really wouldn't make any difference whatsoever. Like, can you just imagine the odds of both of those guys being that good and you still finish, you know, 14 games under 500 or whatever it's going to be? That's just so depressing to me.
Yeah, I could not have imagined that. Would not have imagined that in the slightest.
Oh, and by the way, Scooter Jeanette and Eugenio Suarez are now like world beaters, and yet you're still going to finish that far underneath 500.
I know, it's wild. With Jeanette and Votto and Suarez in the infield, you could make the argument that they have one of the best infields in the National League.
Yeah.
And yet, they're awful. They're just...
And Phil Irvin and Kurt Casale have combined nearly 200 plate appearances of 850 OPS ball. And again, they're awful.
Just not good. Just not good at all. I will say, I have one fun idea. If McCutchen doesn't make it through waivers, if they put him on waivers and somebody picks him up, you know what team that I think would be a really interesting fit for him that's a playoff contender?
Hit me.
The Chicago Cubs.
Oh.
I know that the Cubs have a roster that has plenty of outfielders, but they really haven't gotten the production out of their outfield that I think they wish they would. Hayward's been doing fine. Obviously, Ben Zobrist is doing more than fine. He's been exceptional. Schwarber's been doing fine. But Albert Almora has not been playing very well. I know he's there mostly for his defense, but he hasn't been playing too well. With Addison Russell not playing particularly well comparatively, they could easily move some things around and make Zobrist the regular second baseman with Baez at third or Baez at short. And we don't know what the status of Chris Bryant is going to be coming back the rest of the season. So
that is an interesting idea. I don't know if it's likely because I think they'd probably just rule what they have, but that is interesting.
Yeah, the Cubs are ridiculously high on David Boat, who could, I guess, play some outfield. Though I would not be one of those people who's ridiculously high on David Boat.
Why is that?
Why is that?
Yes.
Why is it that I am not super excited about David Boat?
Yes. Hey, you're the one who brought it up, so I'm just curious now. Because I really don't have strong feelings. I think it's a cool story, and he seems like he's going to be an interesting bench piece. I don't think he's a starter or anything, but then again, I don't know. He's been hitting well, obviously.
He's been hitting well. His BABIP is unreasonably high. He's been doing a nice job taking pitches. I think that pitchers are going to challenge him more because he really does not have all that much power, and I would be surprised if pitchers wouldn't start challenging more and trying to get a little bit more aggressive with him because he really doesn't have much of a history of hitting for any power whatsoever. And he's always been kind of a medium strikeout guy, so I don't think that's really a thing. I think he's gotten relatively lucky on balls in play, and he's a pretty good hitter, but he doesn't have any secondary skills to speak of to back up his tool. Like, his tool levels are not high. So I just tend to give him a little less. I mean, he's doing it at the major league level. You can't argue with that, but I just think it's more of a small sample size thing than he's really a true talent, Chris Bryant level hitter.
Oh, yeah, of course. I thought when you meant you're not that high on him, you didn't see him even as a bench piece. And I was like, well, that seems a bit mean.
I could see him as a bench piece because he's just shown enough at the highest levels over the last couple of years of the minors to, at least get a crack at it. I mean, that's why he's gotten all the playing time he's gotten up to this point. And he can field it. He can pick it a little bit. So, that's certainly worth something to a team like this, but... Yeah, I just...
It's weird because his reputation was that he was out of position. But he could hit a little bit, but he didn't have a position. And now, defensive metrics are high on him. So that's weird.
Yeah, it is. It is weird.
Maybe positioning makes all the difference. I don't know.
I don't know either. But I do know that we have come to the end of our show. So, RJ, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about all these different guys.
Of course. And thank you for causing me a bit of an existential crisis when I didn't really have a lot to say about William Torres, because I was thinking, like, geez, did I miss something? Is this the guy I was thinking it was? And it was the guy I was thinking it was, but it just goes to show you learn something new during every episode here.
That is the first, last, and only time I will be thanked for instigating a existential crisis, I hope. To find more wordplay from RJ, head over to CBS Sports MLB and check out all the wonderful work that he's doing there. You can find more transaction analysis content by myself and the rest of the incredibly talented team at Baseball Prospectus over at baseballprospectus.com, which is also where you can find all the archives for our show and plenty of other great baseball content, so check that out. You can find the DFA Podcast on Twitter, at DFA Podcast. You can get to us by email, dfa@baseballprospectus.com. We look forward to having you guys listen to the show again next week. So until then, take care and have a good one.